This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 5th of August 2014 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Grundig. Hello and welcome to Section D, the hour we devote to the world of design each week here on Monocle 24. I'm your host, Tom Morris. Coming up today, I speak to the curator of the second Istanbul Design Biennial to get a sneaky peek at what we can expect when it kicks off in November.
This is a moment of reflection and critiquing, but also there is a lot of humour, a lot of, you know, playfulness in the biennial.
Featuring anti-apartheid buttons and placards made by gay rights activists in Russia, we head to a new exhibition in London that looks at the role design has to play in spurring on social change.
Students in London, they began making their own shields after seeing what happened in Italy. Then students in New York, Manchester, all over Europe. So that wave of student protest suddenly had a visual identity.
And then we're off to Berlin to discover how pre-war villas are experiencing something of a comeback in the leafier parts of town.
These existing houses, they tell a story. They give you, as a new owner, an identification.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Now to kick off the show, let's head to Barcelona, where a new exhibition is highlighting the increasingly blurred line between art and architecture. The Architect Tones exhibition wraps up a series of art installations housed inside high-profile residences by French artist Xavier Velhan. The artist is using his art as a way of re-exploring what are normally off-limits residential spaces from Los Angeles to Moscow, and now in the iconic Mies van der Rohe Pavilion in Barcelona. Our Madrid correspondent Liam Aldis was on site to talk to those involved in the exhibition series. He asked whether cities should start paying more attention to the often ignored, yet no less important, residential realm, and whether the idea of the temporary suburban museum could take hold.
I'm in Barcelona at the Mies van der Rohe Pavilion. The wine is flowing, the guests are appraising all kinds of surfaces, and there's plenty of flash photography. It may sound like your typical high-profile art opening, but this evening there's much more to celebrate as artist Xavier Velhan brings his seven-part Architect Tones series to a close. Spanning two continents and three cities, the French artist has boldly tried to combine his art with high-profile residential and suburban architecture, reinterpreting iconic spaces in the process.
I was a little bit worried of the fact that maybe I have an idea which is a fantasy about the architecture through books, through studying the plans and the photographs. But actually it's the opposite that happened.
Eager to show his work outside the sterile confines of a gallery space, Velhan wanted to create a dialogue between the art and the location. The first of the series of shows was in Richard Neutra's former LA residence, and to develop the show, Velhan adopted an immersive approach.
So I was very interested in the idea of experiencing the architecture just by working in it, but the first house I made the show in, I also moved in with my family and stand there for over a month at the Neutra Vidal. So it was not only the experience of doing an exhibition in it, it was also the experience of living in it. I met relatives, the sons of Richard Neutra, and we talked a lot, but it was like more anecdotes about how they made parties when they were kids in the house and how what was their experience for the house. And I built some of the pieces on this very narrative aspect, which is very unexpected. I thought I will meet a place and an architecture, but I met people instead.
What followed was a series of shows emphasizing how each house has a story to tell, a story that is shaped by those that use the space as much as by those who created it. We'll hear more from artist Xavier Velhan in a moment, but first I grab a quick word with curator and architect François Perrin. He was tasked with the challenge of knocking on doors and convincing the owners to let the artist and art lovers in.
It was about talking with the owner or the people in charge of the house and explaining them the interest of the project, and that people would visit the house, but at the same time they would visit an exhibition, a temporary exhibition. The first one was at the Neutra House, the VDL research house, which is the first house designed by Richard Neutra. But the first project we did was the first exhibition that ever happened in that structure. The second one was a house that's by Pierre Koenisch, Case Study 22, as part of the Case Study program. And this house is owned by some collectors, art collectors. And the third one took place in one of the most exciting houses of LA or in the world, called the Case, the Schitz Goldstein House. It's by John Lautner, a house that appeared in many Hollywood movies, and which is a hidden house in Beverly Hills, where we did a 3-day intervention.
So could this be a new trend? Could architecture aficionados soon start trolling the suburbs to discover each city's smaller yet equally important icons? And is suburbia set to become a dynamic new staging ground for temporary galleries?
It's just a simple fact of going outside of the classic art space, gallery, museum, institution, which are, you know, sometimes in interesting building, but most of the time in the same white cube. So whether you're in Paris, LA, or Barcelona, you will find the same space. The perception is that you can show art outside of the white cube, outside of the gallery, and it's interesting. It's first, it's bring like it reactivates the architecture, the buildings that sometimes were not really looked at, even if some were open to visit. Like, it gives like a new vision of the house.
The artist has been confronted with the tricky task of attempting to challenge the perception of each space, while at the same time attempting to respect what are considered architectural monuments in their own right. The temple-like Mies van der Rohe Pavilion was perhaps the most delicate challenge of all. Artist Xavier Valian explains further.
One of my fantasies was to strip it down from all the added pieces of furniture, curtain, everything. And it's so beautiful like it is, the bare space, because it's also a seek for clarity. And there is this beautiful idea in the pavilion, for example, that you don't know whether you're inside or outside.
The artist ruptures this horizontal vernacular with an all-penetrating vertical line of wood. It's a simple motif that highlights the fundamental ideas underpinning the space, prompting an even greater appreciation of concepts that were so radical in their time. This marriage of art and architecture is certainly not new, but the dialogue created by both artist and building over this long, fascinating journey through suburbia has certainly been unique. And while this 7-part series will come to a close in Barcelona at the end of August, the artist assures me that there will be similar projects in the near future. And who knows, one might spring up on a leafy street near you sometime soon. For Monocle in Barcelona, I'm Liam Aldous.
That was Monocle's Liam Aldous speaking to the curators and participants of the Architectones exhibition in Barcelona. On the 1st of November, the second Istanbul Design Biennial kicks off its 6-week run in the Turkish metropolis. It follows 2012's hugely successful first edition and is organised by the Istanbul Foundation for Culture and Arts. The theme of this year's edition is "The Future is Not What It Used to Be" and has been curated by Zoe Ryan, the John H. Bryan Chair and Curator of Architecture and Design at the Art Institute of Chicago. Zoe joins me now in the studio to discuss the new young upstart on the global design biennial circuit. So let's start with, what have you got planned and how do you go about when you sort of propose to do this? I always wonder, how do you come up with a theme, something that can encapsulate all the things you kind of, you know, you're posed to do?
Absolutely. The invitation really came out of the blue last summer when they approached me and asked me, you know, would I like to curate the Istanbul Biennial? And of course, I love Istanbul. I've been many times before, but always on holiday. So the idea always to go back to a country and a city and work there is very inviting because you can really dig deep. And I was really thinking, yeah, what does it mean to have a design biennial in Istanbul, in a city and a country that's really kind of emerging, going through a lot of change socially and politically. Very exciting moment to be there. It has a, you know, really exciting architecture and design community. But also to pick a topic that was quite universal and that would work there, but also, you know, in the rest of the world. And I've always loved the future is not what it used to be as a concept, and sort of started to look at this title and look at its origins in this book and the reflections on the world today, which is by Paul Valéry, who was a French poet and philosopher. This came out of his book from 1937. And so that was written at a very special moment between World War I and World War II. And what I love about the quote is he's not just talking about the importance of looking to the future, but to look to the future, we have to understand where we've come from, but also where we are. So bridging sort of history with the contemporary. And that to me seemed very apropos to the time and place in which we're in. We're in our own special moment of a lot of social and political change and unrest, and really the future as we imagined it. What is that future? And what if things were different? And I wanted also a topic that would enable us to suggest alternatives and use designers and architects in the way that what they do best, which is to pose questions and invite possible scenarios for new futures, but also to also position, you know, today's culture of architecture and design.
And you had over 800 submissions.
We did an international call.
Yes. Incredible. How Turkish will this be?
We had over 800 submissions from, you know, all parts of the world, which was just really fantastic and also a great testament to us that, you know, architects and designers are really, they do feel like they have agency and they are really striving to pose those questions and position their work. In the end, we culled that down. We have about 58 projects in the exhibition, and it's by architects and designers working in just over 20 countries. That was a big task, a very interesting task. Obviously, it's a very privileged, you know, you're getting to see, you know, work from across the world, which was one of the reasons why I wanted to do this biennial, was to learn more about what was happening in other parts of the world. It was very challenging to narrow that down. But we also make a big commitment that, you know, a big substantial part of the biennial would be Turkish. So 30% of the projects are from Turkey, which to us it was very, very important.
Istanbul Biennial's already made quite a big splash and already seems quite a major player on the quite full circuit of biennials. What's the sort of pressure with doing the second edition and kind of living up to the first? Is that a huge pressure on your shoulders?
It's a mixture, of course. For me, the pressure comes from wanting to do the best job possible for the architects and designers that are working on projects and producing work for the biennial, which is just incredible. We are very fortunate to have not gone first, so we can sort of learn some of the things from the first one, which I think was enormously successful, and it really set a very high bar. So we have, you know, obviously taken that on board. But I do feel like there's still an emerging concept, and Turkey is an emerging market, so it seems kind of an ideal place for this kind of biennial. I think what was also interesting was, at the beginning, we had a lot of conversations just about what is a design biennial. Still, there are the very few of them. You know, when you're looking at kind of precedents, you sort of return to precedents from art biennials. So the kind of the definition of a design biennial is still to be made. I feel very privileged and honoured to be actually a part of that conversation in a part of the world that is just so interesting, you know, being on the cusp of Europe and Asia, and it has this super well-educated sort of world of young architects and designers that have been educated all over the world and then come back to Turkey. Yeah. And to be part of that conversation and be inviting those kinds of questions with them has been, yeah, very, very interesting and eye-opening.
Give us a little sneak peek of some of the sort of more interesting projects that we can expect.
The biennial itself is going to be focused around a hub space, which is this formerly Greek Orthodox school, which they used in the first biennial and we kind of fell in love with too. And it's five floors and there's a beautiful roof terrace. And the Turkish group Superpool, who are architects, and Projects, which are graphic designers, are helping me design the space. So you're really going to be experiencing the school like you've never done before. And we'll be carving the building in two. So you will walk up one half of the building and walk down the other half of the building. That's about as much sneak peek as I'm going to give you of the design. But it does mean that we are able to choreograph the space and you'll kind of walk through the space. And one thing that's very important to us when we're thinking about rethinking the manifesto and what would a 21st century architectural design manifesto be, we were thinking about, well, one of the important things about manifestos is how they're distributed. You know, the Le Figaro was the sort of platform for distributing the Futurist Manifesto. So we have a broadcast station, very much like Monocle's own radio station here. We will have our own radio station at the biennial in the hub. So the first thing is actually you come into the broadcast station where the workshops and the public programming takes place. But then as you move through the building, you go from projects that start with issues of more personal identity, issues of beauty, issues of emotional and social well-being. And the projects grow in scope and scale. So as you sort of get to the sort of the later part of the biennial, it's more projects about social practice or collective action or public space projects. So it's very important for us that you're taking a journey, because 58 is a lot of projects. How do we provide those kind of hooks into them? So some of the juxtapositions are very exciting. At the beginning, you have projects like Jessica Charlesworth and Tim Parsons, their project about new survivalism, which is rather than bug out bags for when the apocalypse hits, these are everyday toolkits for tackling with everyday situations. And one of the interesting things also about many of the projects in the exhibition is they're being developed with Istanbul and the Turkish context in mind. So there's a lot of designers that will be in residence. We're bringing people out early to do visits in the city and sort of work with people in the city to try and build very strong relationships. One of the bits of research that Jessica and Tim were working on is that in Turkey, over 50% of the population already has an earthquake kit. So they're already thinking about these types of, you know, everyday survival. So Jessica and Tim will make scenarios, I think 6 different types of bug out bags for different types of people. But you'll also be invited to come and make your own, and there'll be a kit of parts that you can use. So a lot of projects are quite interactive, and obviously where you can get to take part and obviously have that moment of personal reflection.
Fantastic. Lots to look forward to. Zoe Ryan, curator of the second Istanbul Design Biennial, thank you very much for joining us on Section D.
For over 6 decades, Grundig has made people's lives better and simpler. To this day, we bring our expert knowledge of design and technology to a wide range of high-quality domestic appliances. Whether refrigerator or radio, oven or audio system, we continue to integrate our manufacturing heritage with state-of-the-art technology. Grundig synthesizes the best of yesterday with the best of tomorrow, expertly and innovatively designed for you and your home. Grundig. Supreme engineering, timeless design.
And staying in London, we cross the city to Kingston University, where one annual workshop attempts to address a very subtle, if perhaps totally unrecognised, aspect of the design industry, the use of scent. This 5-day course, entitled Design with Scent, is for professionals and students across the creative fields, and of course, for fragrance lovers. It's also the only such course in the world to exist. We sent Alexandra May along to the course and let her find out if she had a nose for detail.
Hello, may I introduce you to Alexandra?
Hi.
Is scent more than just a smell? How is it possible that you can recognize a space and bring back the faintest, fleeting memories that you cannot even describe in words just by smelling? If we use our sight, our hearing, and our sense of touch as an essential tool in creative disciplines, there must be a way to maximize any design experience by stimulating our sense of smell. What better way to find out than by joining the experts behind a Design with Sense course? Today, I'm visiting the only course of its kind at Kingston University School of Design, a 5-day workshop for creative professionals and students. The focus? How to design a place through the sense of smell and how to translate that place into a scent.
You'll be selecting words, colors, images that later will serve to you as a reference as you blend. We've been talking about the process of translating. How much our job when we design a scent is that of translating words, images, tactile features into scent.
Course leader Nicola Pozzani is hosting the Blending Day. using architecture and space as inspiration to create a scent, while the previous day, the students looked at extracting spatial ideas from an already existing smell.
They have an introduction to a few ingredients.
This is Fear, which by Christophe Laudermill, who was exhibited as an artwork in an art gallery in Manhattan. Yeah.
This is the smell of being buried alive. Is that right?
To be hiding in the catacombs.
Or buried alive.
One of the students, Olivia, talks about the inspiration behind her group's sensory scenario.
Yeah, we're looking at the history of Kingston and we're trying to recreate the atmosphere that's been removed through modernisation, really. So we've been walking around the riverside and collecting information, sensorial information about textures and scents and all these sorts of things, and we're trying to collate them into something that's been lost, hopefully.
And what's your background? In which kind of context are you hoping to use scent as a tool?
I'm an illustrator, and at the moment I'm really interested in fragrance, and I'm hoping to learn as much as I can about it and hopefully use it in my work somehow, but I'm not quite sure how yet.
And students, Maria and John, talk me through their mood board. Is this what you can choose for the mood board?
Yeah, we've got the magazines, we've got the tags, papers. There's a bit of everything.
Do you have an idea of kind of what you're looking for yet?
We're working on the station, so we were thinking it's a relatively small station and it's a commuter space. So it's very kind of mundane and very modern, and there's a lot of cacophony of screens and information. So we're thinking of bringing back a bit of the nostalgia of the classic railway heritage that British culture has.
I asked John why he picked a railway station.
I'm very interested in railways as well as perfumes. And I live near a nostalgic railway which has been redecorated to bring back life as it used to be when we weren't all so pressed, when travel was a pleasure. And so this is a preserved railway station where it's redecorated in Victorian style with lots of suitcases around made of old leather, such as people used to use to travel in the old days. And, a general feeling of being unrushed and privileged as a traveller instead of being hassled and short-tempered. So we're trying to create a feeling of leisure and relaxation, and we're looking for things to evoke the nostalgic travel of the past.
Nicola Pazani, the course leader who was trained by perfumer Jean-Claude Elena and who is the founder of S-Sense, a unique perfume training company that aims to change people's attitudes towards fragrance, gives me some insight into what it takes to work with scent.
Well, one needs, first of all, to be able to feel, to perceive. In fact, this is why the very beginning of this course is so much dedicated to encourage participants to develop a thorough sensory perception, so using all the senses. So they need to be able to analyze and understand a space through the sense of hearing, through the sense of touch, vision. So starting from, I would say, a thorough sensory stimulation to then venture into understanding how fragrance work, how we can use it as a language to tell a story and to design a place.
Next, fashion and chemistry enter the picture as I interview two more of the course's lecturers. I now have with me Joanna Norman and John Ayres, who are the co-founders of the fragrance consultancy Pandora. My first question for you is, at what point in your life did you identify scent as a tool for design? Because you both have, it took a journey for you to get to scent and to perfume. Maybe I'll start with you, Joanna.
I've worked in the fragrance industry for quite a few years and was very taken with the fashion aspect. Obviously, there are historically, now everybody assumes if you're a fashion designer, you have a fragrance. But I was always intrigued as to what that connection was. Why should what you wear be the same as something to do with how you smell, and looking at that connection between something that we take for granted with part of our tools, our practice tools for designing.
And John, you actually trained to become a perfume maker, just like Nicola did. I'm just interested in finding out how difficult it is to explain the scientific complexities of fragrances to, if you like, the uninitiated, so people who don't really have any background behind it. And is that knowledge a must to use perfume as a tool for design?
Yes, I come from a technical background in chemistry, and I trained as a perfumer in the 1970s and then worked in fragrance evaluation and product development for fragrances. My experience has been not only with fine fragrance, which tends to inform all other areas, but also with the consumer products, including things like space perfumery and air fresheners. And that area of perception and product experience led me into trying to understand how we know that fragrance affects our emotions immediately and intimately in direct pathways to the brain. How could we measure the effect of fragrance on our emotional state? How could we map the mood state of a person who's experiencing a fragrance? And from that, of course, it led into the idea of fragrance being part of a coherent design in terms of product design, imaging, color, shape, advertising, words and music, everything to do with the product development could be linked together coherently with fragrance to make a successful development of a brand. Extended to space perfumery, particularly large space perfumery like concert halls and meeting places, and leading that from that into generally thinking about the influence that fragrance can have on design and the influence that design can have on fragrance.
What I learned, that the process of translating ideas into scent is fascinating, albeit extremely exhausting, considering the fact that our olfactory capacities haven't ever really been put to the test. By the end of the day, all 18 different ingredients in the students' perfume kits started to smell the same. Still, I walk away with the desire to pay more attention to the smells around me, inspired by the idea of designing something intangible and marrying it to something tangible. For Monocle in Kingston, London, I am Alexandra May.
That was Alexandra May speaking to course leader and students of the Design with Scent workshop at Kingston University here in London. This is Section D with me, Tom Morris. A new exhibition at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London is showcasing objects of art and design that were used by different grassroots social movements as tools of social change. The items range from anti-apartheid buttons to hand-painted placards made by gay rights activists in Russia. Appropriately named Disobedient Objects, the exhibition will run until the 1st of February 2015 and will host a series of events in between. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco visited the exhibition and spoke to curator Gavin Grinden. He also spoke with Carrie Reihart, who created a very unusual object which featured in the exhibition.
Why disobedient objects?
We felt like this was, again, the exhibition came out of conversation between myself and my co-curator Catherine Flood. And the objects from social movements, from activist social movements, that do find their way into the museum are often posters. Posters became a collection category in the late 19th century. Museums are excited by them, they have something of public life to them, they're a new medium. But they're also something that's used by activist movements. And so it was in that form that social movement cultures began to slip under the door of museums. But we began a conversation about, well, what about the other objects? What about barricades? What about locking devices? What would it mean to collect those? What would it mean to exhibit those? And would that be possible? And so this is how the kind of idea for the exhibition began.
Was it difficult to collect all those objects? Because I can see that from the exhibition, it's very international. Every single continent in the world.
Yeah, it was very important to us to represent the international spread of movements. That this isn't something that's just done by white Western activists doing creative stuff. This is something that's global. And so it proceeded through partly my own networks, having researched and worked with activist groups for about 10 years on art activism, as an academic and a practitioner. And then people began to suggest stuff to us. And there was a long process of working with the groups. We didn't want to research on them, but with them. And we had to recognize that oftentimes they're the experts. They're the ones who hold the knowledge about how this stuff is done. So we had to step back from our kind of privilege as curators. So we had a series of workshops with activist groups about how their work would be represented, what the exhibition would be structured like, on the physical design of it, as well as the research questions that it would ask. And so that's manifested in a number of ways in the show. Like, for example, there's a dual label system. There are labels written by us in grey, and then there are bright yellow labels written by the users or makers of the objects, which say, in their own words, whatever it is they think is important to note about those things.
And who make these objects? I mean, they're not the traditional designers, commercial designers.
It's a very broad range of people. The exhibition really is about the context in which these things are made. So sometimes the people who make them do have a professional practice as artists or as designers. They're often, or you know, technologists of some kind. Some of the objects are very skilled, but they're produced to be collectively used and collectively developed. So they're often made in a way that's as simple as possible, so they can be easily reproduced so that they can spread.
Can we go through some of the highlights of the exhibition? For example, one that caught my eye, maybe it's not the most famous, but the Barbie Liberation Movement. It was quite an interesting way they did with the Barbie. Can you explain?
Yeah, so one of the objects we have is a video of the Barbie Liberation Organization, who in the 1990s bought lots of talking G.I. Joe dolls and talking Barbie dolls and swapped the voice boxes. And then they put them back on the shelves so that at Christmas time, kids would take home their Barbie or G.I. Joe and Barbie would say, kill, kill, kill. And G.I. Joe would say, hey, let's go shopping. And they released a video which they sent to media organizations saying that this was about the gender stereotyping of children's toys. And they made the video so that it was the toys themselves that had organized a 1970s-style guerrilla group and decided to perform corrective surgery on each other. I'm so very playful, and this got them a lot of attention.
I'm Carrie Reihart. I myself, along with the Treatment Room Collective, made this truck, the Tiki Love Truck. During the time that we were making it, my friend, who's John Joe Amador, who was on death row in Texas, I found out that he was going to be executed. So I actually went to see him and I watched him be executed. And then my friend Nick Reynolds, who's the leading expert on death masks, he flew into Texas and we actually made a death mask of Ash within 1 hour of him being executed, which then went onto the front of this truck. This truck was in the first ever art car parade by Walk the Plank in Manchester. So I think 10 days after he'd been executed, he was paraded down the street with over 40,000 people cheering. So in my way, I think we turned him into a kind of deity. He's kind of, the idea is this is a truck that we can take around onto festivals and drive around and can act as a really powerful statement against the death penalty.
Can you describe the car? Because it looks striking, I have to say.
Well, it's been based on a kind of a tiki idea, which is like Polynesian art. It's very, very orange. It's covered in glass mosaics and in individual ceramic components that I made, which are skulls and text. And yeah, it's very interesting.
That was Monocle's researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, speaking to the people behind the Disobedient Objects exhibition at London's V&A Museum. Still to come on the show, we'll be going to Toronto for a regional focus on architecture with the Globe and Mail's Alex Bozikovich. Plus, we'll head to the German capital of Berlin, whose once luxurious suburban villas are experiencing something of a renaissance. To North America now, and the shores of Lake Ontario, for a Toronto installment of our regular regional design focus. This week, our Toronto researcher Jason Lee sat down with the Globe and Mail's architecture critic, Alex Bozikovich, and started off by discussing the city's ambitious new waterfront proposals before taking a virtual tour of the soon-to-be-open Aga Khan Museum in Toronto's inner suburbs.
Alex, much has been said about how hideous Toronto's 2,000-acre waterfront is, but the city is doing something about it, spending $1.5 billion in total. You've been keeping track? First, though, how did Toronto's waterfront become so ugly?
Well, it's a story that's similar to those in many other cities whose industrial peak has passed. The Portlands were, in Toronto, a place for shipping and for dirty, heavy industry. And in fact, it's a little more complicated in Toronto because the Portlands, which had been intended for that use, in many cases weren't actually built up. So for about a century, much of the port area was a mixture of slightly dirty and unpleasant types of industry and nothing. And over the last generation or so, governments have been struggling to figure out a way to both to clean up that land, which has been complicated, and also to find a way to use it productively, because it is a very valuable commodity situated right on the doorstep of the city's central business district. Now that's been happening.
And so what are some of the highlights of this revitalization?
Well, the government agency in charge has been taking a design-first approach. They've been focusing on planning out these new districts on the Portlands, and before they build them out with residential and office developments, they've been building parks, and very good ones. They've hired some of the world's best landscape architects to design these spaces, including Michael Van Valkenburg from the United States and Claude Colmier from Montreal in Canada, and the results so far have been excellent. In what had been a dead zone for the city, a couple of very remarkable new parks. One is known as Sugar Beach because it is a sort of artificial beach on a pier by the waterfront adjacent to a sugar refinery. And the juxtaposition of a white sandy beach with pink umbrellas and people lounging and sunbathing against what's left of a bit of heavy industry is quite striking. That's one of the calling cards for the city's new waterfront.
Sounds amazing. So what are some things to consider when you're trying to design the perfect waterfront?
Well, one challenge in Toronto, as in other cities, has been balancing sort of the specific interests of the people in the area with a sort of a broader use of the waterfront. We here have been working for many years to try and make the city interact better with the water. And many other cities, including New York right now, are making efforts in that direction. But there's a tension in between putting parkland and putting public space along the water and opening it up to the public on the one hand, and on the other hand, building new development that will generate revenues and also bring people and activity and create a new agglomeration of city life along the water. Both of those are important, and I think the balance here has been quite successful so far.
Any part of the renovations and redevelopment that you're a bit hesitant about?
Well, in theory, it all sounds great. And what we've seen so far has been principally public space, including a couple of remarkable parks. What I worry about at all is just the scale of the redevelopment. Whenever you have one large agency or developer doing a big project, it's very difficult to avoid a feeling of an institutional quality or a corporate quality to the whole thing. You know, a true city, or the best cities, are built up over time. They accumulate new layers, they accumulate new uses, things change and develop. And when you're building a city from scratch, you've got to try and create that quality synthetically. And it's tough. I do see signs that the waterfront agency in Toronto is working on that by introducing a mixture of different uses, different sizes of buildings, and most importantly, by putting pedestrians first. That's one bit of wisdom that we have picked up here, that new city streets have to be pedestrian friendly and have to serve people on all modes of transit in order to be comfortable and viable places.
There's also a new museum opening here. Can you tell us a little bit about it? Who's responsible for it?
The Aga Khan Museum. It's a remarkable story. This is a museum which is just about to open in the inner suburbs of Toronto. It's a museum that includes a collection of art and artifacts from Islamic civilizations over the last 1,500 years or so. Now, it belongs to the family of the Aga Khan, who is the spiritual leader or imam of the world's Ismaili Muslims. And he had been planning to build a museum like this one, which is intended to reveal sort of the arts, including performing arts, of Islamic cultures across the world, and to put that museum in central London. And he had some difficulties with securing the site. And as a result, it wound up here, right next to a new community center for the Ismaili community in what is a slightly unlikely spot, a bit on the fringe of Toronto. But the building and the complex is going to be a remarkable new asset for this city.
You've been to the museum itself. Can you describe some of the architectural elements? What's your take on it?
It's designed by the Japanese architect Fumihiko Maki, the Pritzker Prize winner, and it is beautifully detailed. The building is essentially a long rectangular box that looks as if it's been cinched in around the middle. You know, a very subtly detailed volume in what's an unusual stone, a white Brazilian granite. The materials and the details are refined to an extraordinarily high level, typical of Maki's work, but very unusual here in North America. And just to see the quality of the building, as well as its surrounding gardens, which are formal gardens based on a Persian Islamic precedence, and which are, again, very beautiful and built to a really remarkable standard. You know, just to see that quality of architecture and building here is going to change the game a little bit.
Do you think this will become the iconic landmark for Toronto, a must-see for anyone who comes here?
The quality of the collection, I think, is remarkable enough that people will make a point of visiting it. And I do think that it's going to change Toronto's cultural map a little bit, because Toronto's main cultural institutions, as in most cities, are centered right in the downtown. This is a little bit out of the way, about 12, 13 kilometers away from that area. So people will have to make a bit of a trip. And I suspect many of them will, because it'll be a rewarding trip. And along the way, I suspect that the this new museum, with its set of new influences and new cultural influences on the city, is going to reshape this corner of the city and maybe create a new cultural corridor. That's the promise that the museum's director has made, and I think it's plausible. It will be very interesting to see that play out.
And finally, we cross over the Atlantic to Venice, where Canada is doing something quite interesting at the Venice Architecture Biennale. Can you tell us what they're doing?
Yeah, Canada's pavilion at the Venice Biennale just won an honorable mention, which is a first for Canada. The pavilion this year is curated by a young Toronto office called Lateral Office, two young academic architects and their team. And their focus is on the north of Canada. It's such an enormous part of Canada's landscape, but very thinly populated and in many ways very distant from what's known as the south, that strip of Canada more or less along the American border where most of us live. Now, Lateral Office have studied the conditions in which Inuit people and others live in the north and have looked at their sort of urban concentrations, which are in many ways quite remarkable, just because building anything that far from the rest of civilization requires tremendous leaps of infrastructure just to deliver the materials. You know, to buy groceries there even is a feat. So what Lateral have done is to study how people are living and the inventive ways in which traditional Inuit culture, first of all, and then European and Canadian cultures from the 20th century onward have been changing and reshaping the north. And that's a fascinating little inventory in itself. But what they've also done is proposed a new set of interventions around culture, healthcare, education, bringing together Inuit thinking and Inuit tradition with some of the best ideas in contemporary architecture and urbanism to find new ways to reinvent the north.
And very quickly, do you think this has any chance of actually coming to life?
Well, the north is changing very quickly with mining and other resource extraction, and the Inuit population of Canada is changing very rapidly right now, and there will be new solutions needed. And I hope that some of these within the show, which are fascinating, will be realized.
That was Monocle's Toronto researcher Jason Lee speaking to Alex Bozikovich, architecture critic of the Globe and Mail.
At Grundig, we carefully craft equipment to help you make the most out of your kitchen, which is why we named our new oven and hob appliance collection, We Care. Our multi-taste oven uses three currents of hot air to cook different dishes simultaneously, with 13 cooking functions to choose from and an LCD display. It's one example of how we strive to perfect our technological innovation so that you can enjoy your home, meal after meal. Grundig. Supreme engineering, timeless design.
I'm Tom Morris, and you're listening to Section D. Once a hallmark of luxury and high class in pre-World War II Berlin, the villa is experiencing a revival in the southwest areas of the German capital. These mansions were often positioned alongside lakes in lavishly green areas, and now they're finding new owners, both from Germany and abroad, to breathe new life into old foundations. Melanie Sevchenko visited two historic properties in Berlin to get a sense of the current market and to understand how the exclusivity of villas is still very much alive.
I'm standing along the Havel River in Potsdam, about 20 kilometers southwest of Berlin's city center. I take in the panoramic view in front of me, blue water and lush forest, dotted by the romantic architecture of the 1840s. Nearby is the infamous Glinica Bridge, where the Americans and Soviets exchanged captured spies during the Cold War. And behind me lies the extraordinary Villa Kampfmeyer, positioned in a gated community with a surrounding garden and waterfront view. It's a true symbol of Potsdam's opulence in the neighborhood known as Berliner Vorstadt, a prime area for villas. In the 1910s and 1920s, Potsdam attracted people of affluence, with its parks and palaces. But after World War II, it was absorbed by East Germany, and Villa Kampfmeyer has nobly stood through decades of transition. My guide is architect Petra Kaufeld, who, along with her husband Paul and their firm, Kaufeld Architects, was granted the honorable task of restoring Villa Kampfmeyer for its newest owner, a London-based German financier. The entire restoration took 2 years. Kaufeld takes me in through the side door. We enter the Herrenzimmer, a traditional room specifically designed for men to conduct business or private affairs. Villa Kampfmeyer was built in 1924 by mill owner Kurt Kampfmeyer, who was, until the end of the war, the largest mill owner in Germany. With Baroque details, the villa has 15 rooms and covers an area of 1,000 square meters. Kaufeld, who specializes in restoring historic villas, says the Berlin villa is experiencing a kind of renaissance.
There's a big interest in existing things because these existing houses, they tell a story. They give you, as a new owner, an identification. Okay, there's also a fascination to build houses new, but within an existing one, you mostly have better details, you have the better substance with more love and with more, let's say, it tells you more stories than new buildings do. And you bring your own. And this is also very interesting. It's a challenge because you cannot do whatever you want to do. Most of the buildings are heritage listed. So you arrange like with something pre-existent. You bring yourself and you take the story that is there. I think this is also a really good dialogue.
The Kaufelds also work with new designs for villas.
It's easier to tear it down and to make a new one. This is really easier because you have all the planning and you can do really whatever you want to do. But I like the dialogue with the old things. It's like you meet a nice person and you talk a lot. This is by studying all the plans, the materials, the construction. You get familiar with everything there. And then you start to think the new life into these existing things. Our body is changing the cells, in a continuous process. And this is how cities and places should change. You do not cut up one arm. Tearing down everything is really rude and really aggressive. But working with existing things opens a door like in another world.
The history of Villa Kampfmeyer is anything but short. After the end of World War II, the villa housed the KGB before becoming the headquarters of the Free German Youth Association. In the early 1960s, after the wall was erected, it was used to train the senior executives of the 22 border crossings between East and West Germany, and later to house the employees of the passport control in Potsdam. In the attic, we find the gun and ammunition room. And down in the basement is a former detention cell for those who attempted to defect to the West, but got caught. After the wall fell, the villa became an events and international conference center before the military attaché of the United Arab Emirates moved in back in 2005.
Oh, it is also silk.
Yeah, this is silk on paper.
We walk from room to room. On the ground floor, the walls are covered in textured silk, each room exuding its own tone and color, from pale blue to yellow and lavender. It's a seamless mixture of original adornments and new additions, all blended together in sumptuous cohesion.
Everything is original. The yolk, things there, the ceilings, everything. We had a good idea what they wanted, these architects in 1920. It is different as it was in 1924, but it's similar. I think we made a good translation into modern times also now.
It's in Potsdam where the price of villas has experienced the most dramatic increase. In the Berliner Vorstadt neighborhood, a villa built in 1874 with 347 square meters of living space is listed for 6 million euros. Going west into Berlin, the hotspots for villas are the neighborhoods of Dahlem, Steglitz-Zehlendorf, parts of Wannsee, and Grunewald. Their proximity to nature makes these areas ideal. Historically, most of the industry and factories were built in the east, and so families wanted to move west to avoid pollutants. Bordered by forest and small lakes, Grunewald is asking top dollar for its waterfront mansions. Frank Alia Reich is a real estate agent with Grunewald's Angel and Fulkers agency, which deals almost entirely in villas. He says particularly in the last 10 years, there's been a rising interest in villas in the southwest of Berlin. And with that comes increasing prices. This is related to Germany's low interest rates.
So you could get a bit more property for your money in the moment. So interest rates around 2-2.5% allows a brighter clientele to buy a property which they couldn't afford, for example, 5 or 10 years ago.
Although there are buyers from abroad, most of the clientele remains in Germany. But in fact, most Germans don't own their houses, with ownership rates hovering around 40%. And where villas are concerned, sometimes buyers want the old thing in a new package. Reisch says there's a trend for developers to tear down classic villas and create newer versions on the same plot. But like Petra Kaufeld, he's mindful of history.
If you go for a street with a lot of beautiful old villas, I think you have to respect this as well. You can't tear down just a villa to build something new to make a profit.
That was Melanie Sevchenko touring some of the newly refurbished villas of Berlin. And that brings us to the end of this week's Section D. Today's show is produced by David Pleasant and edited by Alex Funnell. You can contact David at dmp@monocle.com if you'd like to feature on the show or if you've got any comments or questions. I'm Tom Morris. And playing you out, to signal David's new beginning and his new role at Section D, is Absolute Beginners by David Bowie. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.
Nothing much at stake.